Okay, Ecclesiastes. Fortunately, it's the shortest of the books, since we're a little pressed for time. It's fascinating. It's enigmatic. And again, the first question one might have when encountering this book is, what is a book that talks about meaninglessness, asserting meaninglessness, doing in the text, and then giving advice like you find in 7:15 and following? Where it says, I have seen everything in this meaningless life, including the death of good young people and the long life of wicked people. Of course, so it's raising the question of retribution again. And so on the basis of that observation, he says, so don't be too good or too wise. Why destroy yourself? On the other hand, don't be too wicked either. Don't be a fool. Why? Die before your time. Pay attention to these instructions, for anyone who fears God will avoid both extremes of being overly wise or overly wicked. You just wouldn't find that advice in the book of Proverbs. So how are we to understand this book? The first observation to make, which will again lead to a comment about the structure of the book, is that there are two voices in the book. Two voices that are distinguished by whether the voice is talking about the teacher or it is the teacher speaking. In other words, the bulk of the book from 1:12 to 12:7 is the teacher's reflections and advice. But in 1:1 to verse 11 and in 12:8 to 14, you have a second wise man who is speaking to his son about the teacher. Now, I'm not going to yet tell you what he says about the teacher. I just want you to note a verse from there. This is verse 12, where it says, but my son, in verse 9, he says, keep this in mind. The teacher was considered wise, and he taught the people everything he knew. He listened carefully to many proverbs, studying and classifying them. The teacher sought to find just the right words to express the truth carefully. The words of the wise are like cattle prods, painful but helpful. Her collected sayings are like a nail-studded stick with which a shepherd drives the sheep. But my son, let me give you some further advice. Be careful, for writing books is endless and much study wears you out. That's the whole story. Here's my final conclusion. Fear God and obey his commands, for this is everyone's duty. God will judge us for everything we do, including every secret thing, whether good or bad. So, you see, that is somebody talking about the teacher. So, what's important about this observation that you have two voices is you have to ask, therefore, two questions. What's the message of the teacher? And then secondly, what's the message of the book or the second wise man? It's similar to asking the question, well, what's the message of the three friends of Job? And what's the message of the book of Job, though? Those are two different things. Now, even if you think that the second wise man is really, say, the older Solomon and that the teacher speaking in the first person is the younger Solomon, you still have the same dynamic. That is, the thinking of 1:12 through 12:7 represents a particular perspective, which is not necessarily the same perspective as that which is given by the conclusion of the book. So that's what I'm going to do, actually, is ask the question, what is the message of the teacher? I'm going to start with that. And I can summarize that in one sentence. And I'm going to give you the message of the teacher is, life is difficult. And then you die. Life is difficult, and then you die. As a matter of fact, life is difficult in part because you die. So the life is difficult part is the meaningless. The reasons why life is difficult include death, the inability to control time. I'll explain this in a little bit. The inability to control or discern the time. And lastly, injustice. These three factors render life meaningless. Okay, of course, the teacher reflects on death in a number of different places, but let me point you to chapter 12, verses 1 through 7. And actually, earlier I was asked about translations, and they said I worked on the New Living Translation. I lost this vote on 12, 1 through 7. So if somebody has the English Standard Version or the NIV, could you read it loudly for the group for us? I'll read mine eventually, but... Yeah, that'd be great.
This is the NIV.
Great.
Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, and the years approach when you will say, I find a pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark, and the clouds return after the rain. When the keepers of the house tremble, and the strong men stoop, when the grinders cease because they are few, and those looking through the windows grow dim. When the doors of the streets are closed, and the sound of grinding fades, when men rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint. When men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, when the almond trees blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along and desire no longer is stirred, then man goes to his eternal home and mourners go about the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed or the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is gathered at the spring for the winter. Field broken as well, and the lust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it.
So this is a very complex image of growing old and dying, and likening it to a nice sunny day that all of a sudden turns cloudy, and then describes a household where the four classes of inhabitants are sort of languishing, and the house itself is falling apart. And it's describing how, as we get older, and as I read in one article, after you're 18, your body starts slowly crumbling. This article I read, I wish I had brought it with me, it talks about how every part of our body gets smaller except our earlobes. It's kind of... And so it's interesting, in the Hebrew you could tell that both the strong men and the sort of noble, it's verse 3, the guards and the strong men, they are, you know, the servant, male servants and the male owners. And then you have the ones who grind. That's a feminine form. It's the women grinders, the one who grind the grain. Plus the women who look through the window. They are the owners, of course, the women of leisure. And they're all kind of falling apart. Now, it's also a little bit allegorical here. Because when you talk about the strong men stooping and the guards trembling and the grinders ceasing because they're few, you think of the teeth falling out, the back bending, you know, the trembling when you get older. And then look, the women looking through the window grow dim makes you think of eyesight. And you see, that's how I lost that vote. I think this is where the thought for thought translation went too far. The bulk of the committee that made the final decision of the NLT felt that no one would get that unless we helped them. So this is how it's translated there. It says, "Remember him before your legs, the guards of your house, start to tremble, and before your shoulders, the strong men stoop. Remember him before your teeth, your few remaining servants, stop grinding. And before your eyes, the women looking through the windows see dimly." So it's not an incorrect translation, but all translations are interpretations, but this takes the interpretation too far, not in an incorrect way, it just takes it too far, in my opinion. But as I said, I lost that vote. But the point of this passage is, you grow old and you die. And here and elsewhere, the teacher makes it very clear that he has no confident faith in an afterlife. When it says the spirit goes to God and the dust returns to the earth, he's not saying, you know, that our soul goes to heaven. It's kind of a reversal of Genesis 2, where, you know, God created humans out of the dust of the earth and the breath of God. So, death renders life meaningless. And you can see how this works in chapter 2, verse 12 and following. One of the areas that he looks for meaning is in the area of wisdom. And of course, he's a wise man. You would expect that that would be a place where he would find wisdom. 2:12 says, "So I decided to compare wisdom with foolishness and madness, for who can do this better than I, the king? I thought wisdom is better than foolishness, just as light is better than darkness, for the wise can see where they're going, but fools walk in the dark." Okay, so far so good. Not quite the enthusiasm of Proverbs, but showing the relative value of wisdom over folly. But then he goes on and says, "Yet I saw that the wise and the foolish share the same fate. Both will die. So I said to myself, so since I will end up the same as the fool, what's the value of all my wisdom? This is also meaningless. For the wise and the foolish both die. The wise will not be remembered any longer than the fool. In the days to come, both will be forgotten. So I came to hate life because everything done here under the sun is so troubling. Everything is meaningless, like chasing the wind." A second area where the teacher finds life troubling is in the inability to discern the right time. And remember, we said that wisdom depends on knowing the right time to say the right thing or to do the right thing. And indeed, the teacher knows that there are such right times. God has set a season for everything, it says in chapter 3, verse 1 and following. "For everything there is a season, a time for every activity under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to harvest." You can all start singing with the birds if you'd like to at this point. Famous 60s song. But you know, often people will read these verses, stop at verse 8, and then quote the beginning of verse 11 where it says, God has made everything beautiful for its own time. And we'll leave out the rest of the context. And it seems so kind of light and optimistic. But if look at what the teacher himself says in verse 9 after this poem. He says, what do people really get for all their hard work? I have seen the burden God has placed on us all. God has made everything beautiful for its own time. He has planted eternity in our hearts. But even so, people cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end. I concluded there's nothing better than to be happy and enjoy ourselves as long as we can. And people should eat and drink and enjoy the fruits of their labor, for these are gifts from God. So what he's saying is, yes, God has created everything good, everything for its proper time, and he's put within our heart a sense of transcendence, and we're not like the dog that isn't thinking, you know, these grander thoughts, but God has not allowed us in on it. We can't discern the right time. We can't tell the right time, and that frustrates him. I'll come back to other passages in a moment that combine all three of these that'll also make this point clear. But the final thing that renders him renders the judgment meaningless is the presence of injustice. We saw that in 7:15 and following. You can also see it in 8:10 and following. And this is an interesting passage because it shows that Kohelet is, or sorry, that's the Hebrew for the teacher. The teacher is struggling between his theology, that is what he knows, and his experience, that is what he sees. His experience seems to be conflicting with his theology. In 8:10 it says, I have seen, so this is his experience, wicked people buried with honor. Yet they were the very ones who frequented the temple and are now praised in the same city where they committed their crimes. This too is meaningless. So what's he saying? He said, there are these wicked people who prospered during their life and were honored. And now they're dead and they're still being honored. And this is meaningless. And then he moralizes on that by saying, when a crime is not punished quickly, people feel it's safe to do wrong. So he says, this encourages wicked acts because there's no recognizable punishment. But then he kind of catches himself and says, but even though a person sins 100 times and still lives a long time, I know that those who fear God will be better off. The wicked will not prosper, for they do not fear God. Their days will never grow long like the evening shadows. So his observation and his theology, what he sees and what he knows, seems to conflict. But now he comes back to what he sees. It kind of trumps what he knows. And he says in verse 14, And this is not all that is meaningless in our world. In this life, good people are often treated as though they were wicked, and wicked people are often treated as though they were good. This is so meaningless. So again, for these three reasons, Kohelet looks for meaning in wisdom, in wealth, in relationships, in work, in political status and power, and concludes that meaning isn't to be found there. We won't read it, but if you're unconvinced that these three themes really sort of dominate in the teacher's mind, read through chapter 9 where they all kind of come together. Why not? We'll read it. It's too good not to read. Too good in a depressing way. He goes, this too I carefully explored, even though the actions of godly and wise people are in God's hand. No one knows whether God will show them favor. The same destiny ultimately awaits everyone, whether righteous or wicked, good or bad, ceremonially clean or unclean, religious or irreligious. Good people receive the same treatment as sinners, and people who make promises to God are treated like people who don't. It seems so tragic that everyone under the sun suffers the same fate. That is why people are not more careful to be good. Instead, they choose their own mad course, for they have no hope. There's nothing ahead but death anyway. There's hope only for the living. As they say, it's better to be a live dog than a dead lion. The living, at least, know they will die, but the dead know nothing. I mean, the advantage of being alive is you know you're going to die. That's not exactly all that exciting. They have no further reward, nor are they remembered. Whatever they did in their lifetime, loving, hating, envying, is all gone. They no longer play a part in anything here on earth. Go ahead, eat your food with joy and drink your wine with a happy heart, for God approves of this. Wear fine clothes with a splash of cologne. Live happily with the woman you love through all the meaningless days of life that God has given you under the sun. The wife God gives you is your reward for all your earthly toil. Whatever you do, do well, for when you go to the grave, there will be no work or planning or knowledge or wisdom. I've observed something else under the sun. The fastest runner doesn't always win the race, and the strongest warrior doesn't always win the battle. The wise sometimes go hungry, and the skillful are not necessarily wealthy. And those who are educated don't always lead successful lives. It's all decided by chance, by being in the right place at the right time. People can never predict when hard times might come. Like fish in a net or birds in a trap, people are caught by sudden tragedy. Okay, so life is difficult, and then you die. The second wise man evaluates this for his son. Oh, I should point out, and we've read a couple of them, that his message goes on a little bit further, and he says, because of that, carpe diem. Seize the day. You know, enjoy life when you can. And at the end of chapter 5, we see why this is the direction he would advise somebody to go. He says, I'll pick it up at 5:18. It says, even so, I've noticed one thing at least that is good. It's good for people to eat, drink, and enjoy their work under the sun during the short life God has given them, and to accept their lot in life. And it's a good thing to receive wealth from God and the good health to enjoy it. To enjoy your work and accept your lot in life, this indeed is a gift from God. God keeps such people so busy enjoying life that they take no time to brood over the past. So what's he saying here? He's saying, you know, if God gives you the wherewithal, the wealth, and God gives you the health, and you can drink and eat, then that's good because it makes you forget the hard reality of life, which is life is difficult and then you die. It's a note of resignation, in other words. So what does the frame narrator say, or the second wise man? We sometimes call him the frame narrator because he produces the frame around the teacher's words. First of all, he concludes the bottom line of the teacher in verse 8, saying, everything is meaningless, says the teacher, everything completely meaningless. And then he respectfully acknowledges the benefit of the teacher's teaching. Keep this in mind, the teacher was considered wise and he taught the people everything he knew. He listened carefully to many proverbs, studying and classifying them. The teacher sought to find just the right words to express truths clearly. The words of the wise are like cattle prods, painful but helpful. Their collected sayings are like a nail-studded stick with which a shepherd drives the sheep. But, my child, let me give you some further advice. Be careful, for writing books is endless and much study wearies you out. Okay, so what's he saying here? I think he's saying, you know what, my son? I've exposed you to the thinking of the teacher because there's value here. There's an important message for you. And that is that life is difficult and then you die if you stay under the sun, which is the other phrase that the teacher uses. He's talking about life under the sun, which means apart from a sort of full revelation from God. He's trying to figure out life by seeing, by experience, by observation, not from what he knows, namely from, as I'll point out in a moment, say, the revelation that he might have received from God's Word. And so life under the sun is meaningless. But then in the last two verses, the second wise man takes his son and says, well, let's move away from this under the sun perspective to an above the sun perspective. In the Hebrew, it's really very curt. It says, Sof HaDavar, which is basically enough of this. And then he goes, And then, it's very terse. He then says, here is my final conclusion. Fear God and obey His commands, for this is everyone's duty. God will judge us for everything we do, including every secret thing, whether good or bad. Very brief. But when you reflect on it, it's amazing how much he packed into these verses, this verse and a half. Fear God, obey the commandments, anticipate the coming judgment. Fear God is saying, establish a right relationship with God, my son, then maintain it by obeying the commandments, and live in the light of the expectation of the judgment. It's justification, sanctification, and eschatology in a verse and a half. Not only that, when he says fear God, it makes you think of the wisdom literature. When you say obey the commands, it makes you think of what part of the Old Testament? The law, the Torah. And expect the coming judgment? The prophets. So it's kind of like saying wisdom, law, prophets. You know, my son, that's where you are to turn for an above the sun perspective. So there's value into looking at what life is like under the sun, and then, but don't stay there. You know, some of these wisdom teachers, like the teacher, they're helpful, but they're painful. I remember when Alice and I did a youth event when we were in college at my old kind of liberal Presbyterian church. Not kind of liberal, very liberal Presbyterian church. And, you know, a lot of the kids weren't Christians. We knew that. So we wanted to get the gospel message to them in a kind of way that they'd listen to. So what we did, we spent a lot of time looking at songs from, this would have been the early 70s. And we wrote out the lyrics. And I forget exactly what we played, but we played all these songs talking about the meaninglessness of life and how life was difficult and then you die. And we spent the first 45 minutes playing these and having them read the lyrics. And I remember a couple kids were going, oh man, I'm so depressed. This is horrible, horrible. Then we put on a Phil Kagi song. You know, Phil Kagi is still a popular Christian musician, where he talked about the gospel. And it was just, you know, for the last 5 minutes, but it then riveted their attention, and we had a great discussion. I see kind of that's how the book of Ecclesiastes works. Or like Francis Schaeffer used to do apologetics. I remember reading in one of his books years ago that he was going, I don't think he liked to fly, did he? He was on a boat. He was going back to Europe from America, and he met a young sort of existentialist on the boat, and he started talking to this guy and about his philosophy. And he said he spent the whole first day just talking about existentialism, not talking about the gospel at all. and talking about how depressing life is living under an existentialist philosophy. And he said in the book, he said, then I left him for the night, and he said, actually, the guy was so depressed he wasn't even sure whether he might throw himself over the side of the ship, but Schaefer, being a good Calvinist, left that in the hands of God. And but he said he came back the next day and shared the gospel with him after this guy tossed and turned all night. Again, that's kind of like how I see the book of Ecclesiastes working. It makes you look long and hard at what life is like without a real vibrant relationship with God. And then it points you in the right direction. In other words, another way of looking at it is the book of Ecclesiastes is an idol buster. Because what the message is saying is, it's saying if you try to find meaning in anything other than God, it will let you down. It will fail you. And so, you know, if you try to find ultimate meaning in wisdom and wealth and work, you know, it will let you down. Now let's finally talk about reading Ecclesiastes in the light of the New Testament. There's one place where Paul alludes to the book of Ecclesiastes, and that's Romans chapter 8. It's a well-known, important passage in Romans. It says, Romans 8:18 and following, yet what we suffer now is nothing compared to the glory He will reveal to us later. For all creation is waiting eagerly for the future day when God will reveal who His children really are. Against its will, all creation was subjected to God's curse, frustration. There are different English translations. The Greek word is mateotes, which is the Greek word which is used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament for the Hebrew word hevel, which is meaninglessness. God subjected the world to meaninglessness. In other words, God subjected, it's reflecting on the fallen world, the curse, the covenant curse. And that's what life is like under the sun. But then he goes on and says, the creation looks forward to the day when God will join God's children, when it will join God's children in glorious freedom from death and decay. So the passage goes on to talk about the future hope of redemption. And you see, the message of the New Testament, and we could develop this a lot, but I'll just say a few words about it, is that Jesus Christ, who is God Himself, Philippians 2, came and subjected Himself to the fallen world in order to free us from the curse of the fall. And specifically, He experienced death itself to free us from the sting of death. So I think of Ecclesiastes when I'm reading the events of Jesus last week. You know, after the triumphal entry, the broader group of disciples desert Him. His own disciples betray Him. Judas in particular betrays Him, and Peter denies Him. And He's hanging on the cross and He cries out, my God, why have You forsaken Me? And at that point, Jesus experiences hevel, meaninglessness, like the teacher couldn't even fathom. But then He dies and He's raised. And therefore, He's, as I said, removed the sting of death from us. So Jesus is the solution to Kohelet's meaninglessness. Death rendered everything meaningless for Kohelet, but the sting of death is removed. As the message for the Christian reading Ecclesiastes is, put your ultimate hope in Jesus, and everything else can find its proper significance. If you take work or wealth or pleasure or relationships and make that most important, it will betray you. But if you put God first, then your work can have meaning. You know, your money can have meaning. You can have experienced real pleasure in life, etc., etc. So that's the message of Ecclesiastes. We've done a lot in a morning in terms of looking at the three wisdom books. And again, my hope is that I've kind of piqued your interest so you will read and reread these books in the light of what we've said. Well, allow me to close our time together with prayer. Thank you for coming and for your interest in these three books. And I just really do hope and pray you continue to study the Old Testament with equal fervor to the other 27% of the Bible. All right. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for this opportunity to spend a morning deepening our thinking about these three books. And Lord, I do pray that that we would all continue to study them, to derive a deeper knowledge of who you are, and to deepen our relationship with you. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.